Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing improving Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health outcomes and the Indigenous Voice to Parliament referendum. My special guest is Professor James Ward, an infectious diseases epidemiologist and the director of the Poche Centre for Indigenous Health at the University of Queensland. He is one of Australia's leading researchers on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. Professor Ward, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Professor Ward, let me start by asking you, how do you see the state of Indigenous well-being and health at the moment in Australia?
A very complex question, but actually probably of any identifiable population in the Australian community, Indigenous people probably have the worst health status of any other group. And it's a very sad state of affairs. It's not all doom and gloom. Things are moving in the right direction, but from my perspective, far too slow. No matter what way you look at it, hospitalizations, mortality rates, vaccination rates, whatever way you look at it, we're not doing as well as the rest of the population. And that is despite lots of efforts going into things like closing the gap. And I feel like we've lost some sense of urgency about trying to improve health outcomes for our population. And for me, from my perspective, I think we need a much greater focus on equity and potency in what we're doing to try and make faster progress towards equitable health outcomes for our population.
And where does this change need to occur? Does it need to happen at a local health service level, for example?
Yeah, I think for health outcomes, we often look at it in a very narrow way. And actually what impacts health is actually a lot of cultural and social determinants. So starting off with early childhood education, starting off even earlier than that with making sure that mums and babies are off to a good start in life, making sure that education outcomes are good, making sure housing's right, making sure that people have opportunities for equal participation in the Australian community. That's what makes people healthy. Healthcare systems are there when people are generally sick, but our people use those health services far too often, and often they have very negative experiences in those healthcare services, except for the Indigenous-led services around the country. And so I think we do need to make much greater efforts in the healthcare system, make sure we can get more efficiency in that care system, make sure that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have good experiences when they're in that care system, but more importantly, trying to prevent them from being there in the first place. And that's by looking at things holistically. I think we have to do much better across the whole gamut, because the health is not seen in isolation for our people. It's actually the health of our communities, the health of our land, the health of the nation is what impacts individual people's health.
And Professor Ward, you've recently done a study about the barriers and facilitators to hepatitis C treatment for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in rural South Australia. Let me ask you about those findings. For example, one of the findings was that Aboriginal people faced overlapping stigma and discrimination in the healthcare system. Were you surprised by that outcome?
Not necessarily. I think we've known for a very long time that there's a lot of intersectionality when it comes to addressing Indigenous people's health in this country. Indigenous people's identity, intersectionality around racism and stigma and discrimination, and intersectionality about general health outcomes. All those three things come together. And then, of course, latent on top of all of that is systemic structural barriers that impact Aboriginal people's access and care. And the hepatitis C study, and more generally hepatitis C in Australia, is a very good example of what needs to change for our people. So in Australia, we've had a curative drug for people who live with hepatitis C available since 2016. And the fact is that we have more hepatitis C now in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community than we did before a drug was available to cure it. That drug is relatively side effect free, available, it's free. It can be administered at almost any place It can be done through an Aboriginal medical service or any other general practice clinic. You don't have to see a specialist. But the fact is, we're not winning the game with ending hepatitis C with our population. And what drives that is intersectionality, as what I said before, racism, stigma, discrimination in healthcare, but also racism, stigma, discrimination because you're living with a virus, racism, stigma, discrimination because of the behaviour that might have led to that virus. And then on top of all of that is the systemic structures that exist in healthcare systems. So availability of testing and initiation of treatment on the same day rarely happens. And until we start to break down all of those barriers, then we can move to a better space.
And that brings me to the importance of discussing cultural safety. Let me ask you about cultural safety, creating an environment that is safe for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Are you seeing that happen at a local health service level in Queensland?
The sector that does that very well is the Aboriginal and Islander Community Controlled Health Services. These are services that have been set up for around 50 years now, the first ones in Australia. They are set up by Aboriginal people, they're governed by Aboriginal people, they're led by Aboriginal people, and they often employ a majority of Aboriginal staff in those services. Those places are culturally safe. Now, I wish I could say the same for every hospital around the country, but I know that's not the case. And we do need a much more focused effort on making hospitals, general practice clinics, our mainstream healthcare providers much more culturally safe. And that's a big piece of work, but I actually think we have to start somewhere.
Let me take a step back and talk to you about research. You've done a narrative review about Indigenous people and cancer, which calls for more research into this area. Can you talk to me about your findings of that narrative review and what you'd like to see happen?
That was a review of cancer pathways between primary care and surgical pathways and hospitals. And what we find is often there's a drop-off between primary care and specialist care. And again, it talks to the point I said earlier about systemic and structural barriers that are in place, often without people recognising them, that impact Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's ability to access and utilise those services. It's the same for any condition, but cancer is just an example. I think there are many structures and barriers in place that we could dismantle. And the problem, you know, this stems from being set up in a colonial environment and not from an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander perspective, these healthcare systems. And of course, we have to start somewhere, but of course, we can start again by dismantling structures that impede people's access and utilisation of healthcare services.
And can you give me an example of those barriers and those structures that you're talking about?
Sometimes they're overt and sometimes they're very covert. Maybe the way the receptionist treats somebody on arrival at a health service. It may be the upfront fees that are required for specialty care. It may be that these are difficult issues for all Australians. It may be access to the hospital. Maybe long waiting times, and then when their appointment time does arrive, that there are other priorities for Aboriginal people, particularly around sorry business that often arises for our people, and then it's back on a waiting list, back to the end of a waiting list in another 3 or 6 months' time. These kind of issues impact our people daily, and they're the kind of structural barriers. More flexibility in the system, more training, more ability to recognise what these barriers are, and so we can start to dismantle them, whether it be covert or overt structural barriers, whether it's racism, whether it's stigma and discrimination that's imposed on our people. It is often the case when our people are accessing healthcare. It's often the way that clinicians are talking to our people. I've been in many situations with elderly relatives of my own in the hospital. Doctors often, not only doctors, but clinicians often come into the room. They explain a whole lot of stuff all in one big sentence, and our people are left bewildered. And, you know, without our people in the room, our people are often don't know what's happening with their healthcare when they're in these systems. So it's really, a lot of it is about empathy and caring and sensitivity and recognizing where people come from. That's the basics. But yeah, sometimes it's other structural barriers that get in the way for our people as well.
And turning now to the Indigenous Voice to Parliament referendum, how much would a voice help in terms of improving health and wellbeing outcomes?
It's a very good question, and it's a fairly straightforward question to answer, actually. For me, the voice referendum is a very straightforward proposition for the Australian public. And that proposition is, should Aboriginal people have a voice about their own futures? And of course they should. All the evidence says when Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people have a say in their health outcome, they have better health outcomes. Elevating that to the executive arm of government, where Aboriginal people would be able to have a say, irrespective of what government were in power of the day, is just straightforward common sense to me. And it's the very minimum that the Australian population could do. If they're concerned about Indigenous people's lack of progress around health equity, if they're concerned about how much money goes into Indigenous affairs, they should vote yes, because actually what we've seen since 2007 is about $50 billion put into closing the gap efforts. And very limited outcomes in the right direction for our people. And that's because the voice is so important, is because if our people are at the table, we can have better outcomes. And a very good example of where we had very good outcomes when our people were at the table is during COVID-19. And I can really talk to you about this because I was heavily involved in the COVID response for Australia, but also the COVID response for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. From the very first month of COVID arriving in Australia, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we recognised that we were in the firing line for COVID-19 if it got into our communities. And so we acted very quickly. We set up structures at the national level. We utilised existing structures, but we also set up new ones. And our people had a direct meeting with the executive arm of government, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples had a very good outcome with COVID-19 during the first 2 years of the outbreak. And that was because we had a say, we were meeting regularly, we recognised the risk for our population, we knew what was working on the ground, we had input and into what the responses should be from the ground up. And that was fed up to the executive arm of government. And the executive arm of government, who often are not involved in policy making, ensured that the policy was enacted. And so, amazingly, of all Indigenous populations around the world, we probably did best of all Indigenous populations in similar situations to Australian Indigenous people, out of all the other global populations. In the first 2 years, about a year and a half in, we had a rate of COVID-19 six times less than that of non-Indigenous Australians. And that was because we had a very good voice that was fed up from the ground up into government, and government acted on it very clearly. Right now is opposite with Indigenous affairs. Often policy is driven out of a department, and often people working in those areas haven't really met Aboriginal people, haven't been to communities, haven't seen the extent of disadvantage, haven't understood the strength and agency in those communities, and haven't understood how things work in communities for our people. And so it's driven from a very different place. But if actually Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal allies of ours can have a say with the executive arm of government, we will be in a much better place in a very short period of time compared to where we've been with the voice over the last 15 or 16 years now.
Professor James Ward, thank you so much for joining me today.
No worries. Thank you.
Professor James Ward is an infectious diseases epidemiologist and the director of the Poch Centre for Indigenous Health at the University of Queensland. You can find more podcasts on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.